This is the second day of this August 2009 two-day session, and I'm going to continue reading from the book Nothing Special, Living Zen by Charlotte Joko Beck. And I'm going to move ahead and begin with a section that's called The Fall. And so she starts out here, "There was once a man who climbed to the top of a 10-story building and jumped off. As he passed the fifth floor on his way down, he was heard to say, 'So far, so good.' We laugh at the man because we see what's coming up for him in a moment. How can he say he's doing well so far? What's the difference between the second when he is at the fifth floor and the second just before he hits the pavement? The second before hitting the pavement is what most of us would call a crisis. If we think that we have only a few minutes or days before we die, most of us would say this is a crisis. On the other hand, if our days are proceeding normally, the usual job, the usual people, the usual tasks, life may not seem wonderful, but at least we're used to it. At such times, we don't feel we're in a crisis, and we may not feel impelled to practice with diligence. Let's look at the supposed difference between crisis and non-crisis." Okay. Session is an artificial crisis. When we commit ourselves to a retreat, we have to stay and struggle with a difficult situation. This is really, as painful as it may be, this is one of the great virtues of Session, is that it's so damn hard. We learn things that we would not learn any other way. We can hear it, we can daydream about it, but until we're down in the trenches, it's all daydreams. Session can be really humbling, maddening, frustrating. It can be exhilarating and affirming. We couldn't do it if it wasn't for everyone else. Just by coming to Session, we're making something wonderful possible for other people. She says, "By the end of the retreat, most of us have gone through the crisis, at least enough so that we see our life somewhat differently. It's sad that we don't understand that each moment of our lives, drinking a cup of coffee, walking down the street to pick up a paper, is it. That's it. Why don't we grasp that truth? We don't get it because our little minds think that this second that we're living has hundreds and thousands of seconds that preceded it, and hundreds and thousands of seconds still to come, so we turn away from truly living our life." Been there, done that. It's so contrary to our pattern to pay attention to this moment, just this. We're almost wired to take shortcuts. It's probably even driven evolutionarily. Probably has some survival value for us not to look at the things that are not immediately threatening us and keep scanning the horizon for those that do, or not look right here at what may be pleasurable, but look for what's more pleasurable down the road. Again, she says, we turn away from truly living our life. Instead, we do what human beings spend all their time doing, which is a complete waste of time. We try mentally to scheme so that we will never have to suffer through a crisis. We spend all of our energies, trying to be liked, successful, nice, agreeable, assertive, or non-assertive, depending on what we think will do it for us. This is everybody has their own version of how to cope. It's amazing how much of our attention, how much we're predisposed to find a safe place, do what will make us safe. Even more than do what will make us feel good. Just do what will make us feel average, comfortable. It doesn't even have to be comfortable. It just has to be something we know, something we're familiar with. We're always heading off in that direction. We have a million reasons we can give ourselves for what we do, but if we could really stand back and look dispassionately, objectively, we'd see that that's so much what we're doing. Just defaulting to same old, sometimes it's zoned out. It's hard to go against the grain. She says we have schemes. Most of our energies go into these schemes as we try to handle our life so that we never hit the bottom. That's why it's so wonderful to get close to the bottom. That's why people who are seriously ill or who have a devastating circumstance in their lives often wake up. Wake up to what? What do we wake up to? Then a student pipes up, to the present? Yes, and what else? To impermanence. Impermanence, all right, that's true. To our bodily sensations? Yes, and more than that, we wake up to what? Finally, a student says, the wonder of it all. The wonder of this second. When this second is not me or anything else, but just, oh. And that doesn't mean some giant emotion, but just, that all of our worries are non-existent. We said yesterday, we have to leave this moment if we want to worry. Usually we have such a realization only when we are pressed hard enough that our mind is pulled into the present moment. Then we can forget all our schemes of fixing ourselves, somebody else, or circumstances. Most people spend 50 to 90% of their waking hours trying to avoid the bottom. Yet we can't avoid it. We're all on our way down, every one of us. We can't avoid the bottom, but we spend most of our life trying to do that. Waking up means realizing that our situation is hopeless and wonderful. There is nothing for us to do except simply to live this second. When we're in crisis or in sesshin, we may not wake up fully, but we wake up enough so that the way we see our life shifts. We realize that our usual maneuvers, worrying about the past, projecting an imaginary future, don't make sense. They waste precious seconds. From one point of view, we're always in crisis. We're always falling toward the bottom. From another point of view, there is no crisis. If we're going to die in 1 second, is there any crisis? No, there's just that second. 1 second we're alive, 1 second we're dead. There's no crisis, there's just what is. Actually, a crisis Something can't be a crisis unless there's something for you to do. Otherwise, it's just the way things are. We can make it a crisis by railing against reality. But as the song goes, I fought reality, reality won. The human urge to do the impossible, she says, keeps us mucked up. We spend our lives trying to avoid the unavoidable. Our energies, our emotions, our projects go into making money, being successful, having everybody like us, because we secretly believe that such things will protect us. One of our most powerful illusions is that being in love can give us real protection. In reality, there is no protection. There is no answer. Our lives are absolutely hopeless. She's so cheerful. That's why they're wonderful, and it's not a big deal. That's it. That's it right there. Hopeless, wonderful, no big deal. What's horrible is living a life where we never touch on this truth. To be caught up for 80 years scheming and maneuvering, complaining, criticizing. That's what's horrible. Who wants to be successful? Who wants to be liked? All of us. There's nothing wrong with such wants unless we believe the illusion. Even wanting to make $1 million can be great fun, as good a game as any, if we see it simply as a fun game, and we don't hurt people as we play it. But we don't see it as a game, and so we hurt others as we pursue our lethal path. Of course, always, always putting ourselves first. So difficult not to act out of self-interest. Even our altruism, when we look at it closely, is usually self-interest. Another way to feel good about ourselves. Enlightenment is simply knowing the truth, not in the head, but with one's whole being, knowing that this is it. Knowing it with your body. This is why we go to Sesshin. She says, it's wonderful. Got a toothache? That's also it. Wonderful. When we think about a toothache, of course we don't think it's wonderful, but it is wonderful simply to be what life is in this second, toothache and all. As we chant, the great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose, for those who have no preferences. The moment we can open up enough, have the courage enough to say yes to whatever comes, everything changes. As long as we're behind our wall trying to protect ourselves, everything's flat and dull. She says, unfortunately, our human minds do us in. For the most part, animals are less manipulative with their lives. Sometimes they may try to play tricks. I once had a dog who didn't like to come home when he was called, so he'd stand behind the hedge on the opposite side of the street. That worked well in the summer. He'd stand hidden behind the hedge just as quiet as could be. But when the leaves fell off in the fall, he'd still run there to hide, standing quietly and completely visible. Still, dogs and other animals do not get as confused as we do about the purpose of their lives. Unlike us, they just live. Some of us are in the middle of disasters, others are not. Of course, we don't stay forever in the middle of a major disaster. Good thing to remember when you're in one. But when we're in the middle of one, we practice hard, showing up at the Zendo more often, doing whatever we can to cope. Then, when life settles down, we cease practicing with such intensity. This is my experience. One mark of maturing practice is to see that life is always totally a crisis and totally not a crisis. They're the same thing. In a mature practice, we practice just as hard whether there's a crisis or not. Crisis or no crisis, we just do it. This is really coming along the path when we just do this practice without having to give ourselves a reason. Shift where not to sit would be like not brushing your teeth. Paying attention becomes a way of life. This is when progress can really happen, whatever progress is. She says, nothing is really solved until we understand that there is no solution. We're falling and there's no answer to that. We can't control it. We're spending our life trying to stop the falling, yet it never stops. There is no solution, no wonderful person who can make it stop. No success, no dream, no anything can make it stop. Our body is just going down. This can be painful to hear. This is basic Buddhism. One fact we know is the fact of our death, and the fact of the uncertainty of the time of death. Joko says, the fall is a great blessing. If someone announced a pill that would cure death and allow us to live forever, that would be a true disaster. Picture yourself in 6,000 years still thinking the same old thoughts. With a cure for death, the whole meaning of being on this planet would change. And where would we put the new babies being born? All of us are aware of aging. Gray hair, wrinkles, twinges. From the time we are conceived, we are dying. When I notice such signs, I don't rejoice. I don't like them any more than you do. Still, there's a big difference between disliking change and trying frantically to stop it. It is painful to see someone who's aging, who gets totally obsessed with taking a million different pills and a million different regimens that somehow are going to keep them young, let alone the horrors of cosmetic surgery. People whose eyebrows won't even move. Sooner or later, we realize that the truth of life is the second we are living. No matter whether the second is at the 9th floor or on the 1st. Sooner or later, we realize. We will realize this. This is the truth. This is our nature. It's not far away. It's not something that we have to twist our minds around to get. Just have to get out of the way, and there it is. We will. In a sense, our life has no duration whatsoever. We're always living the same second. There's nothing but that second, the timeless present moment. Whether we live the second at the 5th floor or right over the pavement, it's all the same second. With that realization, each second is a source of joy. I'm going to jump right now to a section a little farther on, which is titled Joy. See if she can lighten it up a little bit. She says, I'm often accused of emphasizing the difficulties in practice. The accusation is true. Believe me, the difficulties are there. If we don't recognize them and why they arise, we tend to fool ourselves. Still, the ultimate reality, not only in our sitting but also in our lives, is joy. By joy, I don't mean happiness. They're not the same. Happiness has an opposite. Joy does not. As long as we seek happiness, we're going to have unhappiness because we always swing from one pole to the other. So what is she talking about? She says, from time to time, we do experience joy. It can arise accidentally or in the course of our sitting or elsewhere in our lives. For a while after Sesshin, we may experience joy. Over years of practice, our experience of joy deepens if, that is, we understand practice and are willing to do it. Most people are not. It really is totally dependent on willingness. Not on skill. Aptitude. Really comes down to willingness. Of course, willingness changes as we practice. When we begin, we're willing a little bit. Try it out. But if we keep at it, things do change. All we really need is enough willingness to keep moving along the path, not to quit and not to sit down and stop. She says, joy isn't something we have to find. Joy is who we are if we're not preoccupied with something else. Say that again. Joy is who we are if we're not preoccupied with something else. Another way to put it is, if we're not looking outside ourselves or looking outside this moment, and there's no difference. This moment is our true self. When we try to find joy, we're simply adding a thought, and an unhelpful one at that, to the basic fact of what we are. We don't need to go looking for joy, but we do need to do something. The question is what? Our lives don't feel joyful, and we keep trying to find a remedy. She says our lives are basically about perception. By perception, I mean whatever the senses bring in. We see, we hear, we touch, we smell, and so on. That's what life really is. Most of the time, however, we substitute another activity for perception. We cover it over with something else, which I'll call evaluation. By evaluation, I don't mean an objective, dispassionate analysis, as, for example, when we look over a messy room and consider or evaluate how to clean it up. What I have in mind is ego-centered. Is this next episode in my life going to bring me something I like or not? Is it going to hurt or isn't it? Is it pleasant or unpleasant? Does it make me important or unimportant? Does it give me something material? It's our nature to evaluate in this way. And this evaluation, by the way, can be almost totally unconscious. We can be totally unaware that this is how we're sizing people up, by what good they can do us, how they might amuse us, jobs, situations, teachers. We have a hidden bias, hidden even to ourselves most of the time. And, as she says, to the extent that we give ourselves over to evaluation of this kind, joy will be missing from our lives. You can contrast this with the way a baby approaches life. Babies have no idea what can hurt them and what can't hurt them. They're just open to everything. And they're just bubbling over with joy. It's their nature. It never went away. All of us were babies, I think. It never went away. It just got covered over. When we learn, I have to watch out for this. I want more of that. They're both painful. Avoiding pain is painful. Seeking pleasure is painful. She says, it's amazing how quickly we can switch into evaluation. Perhaps we're functioning pretty well, and then suddenly somebody criticizes what we're doing. In a fraction of a second, we jump into our thoughts. We're quite willing to get into that interesting space of judging others or ourselves. There's a lot of drama in all of this, and we like it more than we realize. Unless the drama becomes lengthy and punishing, we enter willingly into it because, as human beings, we have a basic orientation toward drama. From an ordinary point of view, to be in a world of pure perception is pretty dull. Suppose we've been away on vacation for a week, and we come back. Perhaps we've enjoyed ourselves, or we think we have. When we return to work, the inbox is loaded with things to do, and scattered all over the desk are little messages, "While you were out." When people call us at work, it usually means they want something. Perhaps the job we left for someone else to take care of has been neglected. Immediately we're evaluating the situation. Who fouled up? Who slacked off? Why is she calling? I bet it's the same old problem. It's their responsibility anyway. Why are they calling me? Likewise, at the end of sesshin, we may experience the flow of a joyful life, then we wonder where it goes. Though it doesn't go anywhere, something has happened. A cloud covers the clarity. Until we know that joy is exactly what's happening, minus our opinion of it, we're going to have only a small amount of joy. When we stay with perception rather than getting lost in evaluation, however, joy can be the person who didn't do the job while we were gone. It can be the interesting encounter on the phone with all the people we have to call, no matter what they want. Joy can be having a sore throat. It can be getting laid off. It can be unexpectedly having to work overtime. Remember when I first came to the center, there'd been an article about Roshi Kaplow in the New York Times Magazine, and he commented on the beauty in an angry face, and at the time it just made no sense to me at all, but it's there. When we're not walling things off through our preferences, then everything is lit. Everything is wonderful, interesting. Even pain is interesting. Difficulties. Having to do what we don't want to do. I have an article that my wife emailed to me from the New York Times. Not sure if it was published in the Times or just in some blog that they have. It's from a column called Happy Days. The subtitle of the column is The Pursuit of What Matters in Troubled Times. And the article itself is called O Sting, Where Is Thy Death? It's by a guy named Richard Conniff. Written on August 10th, not that long ago. And Richard Conniff has had articles appearing in the Smithsonian, National Geographic, Time, The Atlantic, The New York Times Magazine, and other publications. He blogs at strangebehaviors.com. I'll have to go check that out. But this really says everything we're trying to say, so I just want to read it out. He says, "Not long ago I got stung by a yellow jacket, and after the usual ow plus obscenities moment, I found myself thinking about pain, happiness, and Justin O. Schmidt." He's an Arizona entomologist and co-author of the standard text in the insect sting field, Insect Defenses, Adaptive Mechanisms, and Strategies of Prey and Predators. But he's more widely celebrated as the creator of the Justin O. Schmidt Sting Pain Index, a connoisseur's guide to just how bad the ouch is on a scale of 1, a tiny spark, to 4, absolutely debilitating. Among connoisseurs of insect stings, it's the equivalent of Robert Parker's wine ratings. Schmidt has been stung by about 150 different species on 6 continents and seems to have opinions about all of them. In faux Parker mode, he once described a bald-faced hornet sting as, quote, rich, hearty, slightly crunchy, similar to getting your hand mashed in a revolving door. Other researchers tend to regard his work with fascination, but hardly anyone tries to replicate his results. You are probably thinking that this does not sound like it has much to do with happiness. And here we could, using Joko Beck's terminology, we can substitute joy. This is the joy that she's talking about. It does not sound like it has much to do with joy, especially not on a hot summer day with the insect world chattering and buzzing just outside the screen door. But Schmidt struck me as a happy guy when I first looked him up a few years ago at the home in Tucson he shares with a wife, 2 kids, and a large collection of venomous arthropods. I was researching my book, Swimming with Piranhas at Feeding Time, and he seemed like a good fit with my subtitle about doing dumb stuff with animals. We sat down to talk at the kitchen table. The only condiment was a tube of Itch-X. Maybe I'd been reading too much positive psychology, but it struck me that you could make Schmidt's work a case study, okay, a somewhat perverse case study, in happiness. It was, for instance, all about flow. That's the term happiness researchers use for the sense of well-being that comes from getting so caught up in what you're doing, so focused and energized by it, that time passes by unnoticed. For athletes, flow is about being in the zone. For stock traders, it's about being in the pipe. And for Justin Schmidt, clearly, it's about being knee-deep in a nest of stinging insects. He never gets stung on purpose, he said. Too artificial. The insect might not deliver a normal dose of venom, but his research on bees, wasps, and ants often requires him to hunt down and collect obscure species, so he has plenty of opportunity for instructive mistakes. What happens is, you've been looking for a species for maybe for years, he told me. You finally find a nest, and by God, you're going to get every one of them. You get your buckets and your aspirators, and you start digging away. In the excitement, a few stings are almost inevitable. Positive psychology types like to say that savoring the moment is a crucial happiness skill, and that's what Schmidt does next. He says, so I pay a little attention to the type of pain it is, how long it lasts, how intense it gets. A harvester ant, for instance, felt like someone was putting a knife in and twisting it. A wasp, known in the American Southwest as the tarantula hawk, made him lie down and scream. The good news is that by 3 minutes it's gone. If you really use your imagination, you can get it to last for 5. On the other hand, the sting of a bullet ant in Brazil, remind me never to be stung by a bullet ant in Brazil, 4+ on the pain index, had him, quote, still quivering and screaming from these peristaltic waves of pain 12 hours later, despite the effects of ice compresses and beer. It's just amazing how any experience is so determined by our attitude towards it. Here's a guy who finds nothing more interesting than insect stings. He has a great line later on. He says, we typically outweigh any insect tormentor by a million times or more. We can outthink it, and yet it wins. And the evidence that it has won is that people flap their arms, run screaming, and do all kinds of carrying on. It wins by making us hurt far more than any animal that size ought to be able to do. It deceives us into thinking serious damage is being done. And that's generally enough to deliver the insect's message, which is, stay away from me and my nest. We're always thinking that serious damage is done or going to be done, when in fact, it's not. Insect sting is a good example. Of course, if you're one of the 1 or 2% of people who are allergic to insect stings, that's a different matter. But for the rest of us, it's just a moment of pain that passes, and usually more quickly than in 12 hours. When we approach something like that with that open mind, that willingness to see what it is, that interest in seeing what it is, everything changes. Everything opens up. We drop our defenses and suddenly we don't need to be defended anymore. If we can come to our sitting and the difficulties of our sitting, not just the physical pain, there's emotional pain, there's frustration. If we can have that initial attitude of curiosity, what's this going to be like? What's really here? Let me see where this goes. We're capable then of so much more. We're not locked down, not walled off. People sometimes on their deathbed have this curiosity. What's coming next? What's it going to be like? What's this like right now? What is this? There's nothing we know completely. Everything can open up more to us. Just need to let go of the idea that we know what to expect. We've been here before. We've done this before. We're new. Each of us. We're little babies. Need to explore our world. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.